to spend his life between Miami and New York City, answering legal questions. And soon, if all goes well, and if there's any justice in this world, this man will spend some time in jail. I'm Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We call it Flashpoints. A privilege to broadcast to you over these free speech Pacifica radio airwaves, KPFA, in the San Francisco Bay Area. Stay safe.
Wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Our roving producer and producer of Flashpoints in Espanol is Miguel Gavilan Molina. Our technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net or visit our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/flashpoints. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Welcome to Bookwaves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Noel Kassler, and I guess this is the first time I have a Twitter writer. He's a stand-up comedian, and I guess you've not been able to do stand-up now for 10 months.
This is true. Stand-up has been shut down, which, you know, increases the Twitter presence, but I do miss the clubs. I was mainly based in New York City, and I'm working on a book, so most of my writing is on Twitter, and that's where most of the people keep begging for a book.
Let's go into your background. What we're going to be talking about here, you spent 6 years as a staffer at Celebrity Apprentice, 3 years with Ivanka Trump. A couple of questions just to see what we've got here. Proof of being on the Celebrity Apprentice, I guess, is because Mark Burnett, the producer, could have easily debunked you if you weren't, correct?
Yeah, no, I was there. I mean, that's not really up for debate. I work in the talent department, so I worked in live television, which is a very specific thing. So I worked on everything from Super Bowl halftime shows to the Grammys to the Tony Awards. Kennedy Center Honors is where I began my career 25 years ago. So I handle talent when there's a live network broadcast where there's a lot at stake. So for NBC, I worked on the Celebrity Apprentice finales. So I did 6 seasons of it, the last 3 where I took care of Ivanka. But yeah, Mark knows me well. There's pictures of me and him. My side of things is they bring in freelancers to handle all the talent on shows. So we're not in the crew in the typical sense. We're like, you know, a grip or a gaffer. We come in to handle the celebrities that are going to be appearing on air and all the logistics behind the scenes. So my specialty is talent logistics, and that means all the movements, you know, the getting out of the car to the dressing room, dealing with their needs. And that's where you actually see a lot of things that you maybe aren't meant to see. you know, and the same people keep doing that over and over, because if you're discreet about it, you'll work in that business. And I'd never revealed anything until I decided to break that NDA and speak out about Trump. I've worked with Michael Jackson. I've worked with Madonna. I've seen all kinds of things. The one standing rule in my business is you don't talk about the talent. And I never did until Trump was, you know, the candidate in 2015. And the things I knew about him, I knew he was a danger to this country. It wasn't just a political thing. I spoke out because the guy I know is one of the most dangerous human beings I've ever met.
You worked with Trump before. Was your connection with Trump or with the people who hired you? How did that work?
It's the people who hired me. It was actually the same production coordinator that I started with on the Kennedy Center Honors in 1993. I was in New York getting hired on the Tony Awards and the MTV VMAs, and that's where I got the gig working on the Miss Teen, or was Miss Teen USA and Miss Universe pageant. They're both the same thing. And they were directed by the same guy who directs the Oscars now.
Those of us from New York knew about Trump. He was kind of, to coin a word, a sphincter. Everybody knew that, right? Everyone knew that. He was a celebrity mostly known for being a celebrity. He was famous for being famous. And of course, he palled around at Studio 54 and nobody really cared that much, except when he put up buildings that blocked views and sift people. So how did you meet Trump, and what was your first reaction to him? This is long before he became the other person.
Right, and you just reminded me of, remember when he tore down the Bonwit Teller building and they had those beautiful like friezes that were promised to the Met, and he had a bunch of laborers smash them in the middle of the night? You know, that was, I don't know if you remember that, but that was when he was building Trump Tower. So he was that kind of New Yorker. And I grew up in New York in the 80s in Westchester outside of the city. So I always knew Trump as the sort of cartoon character, you know, like Crazy Eddie. You know, he was like a cross between, he was like a racist Crazy Eddie to me, because I remember the Central Park Five and all that kind of stuff. So when I first saw him, I had these memories that most New Yorkers have of him. You know, somebody who was sort of like never accepted by Upper East Side, you know, New York society, but was going to kind of will his way into the stratums anyway. You know, so it was all the gold-plated stuff and the model wives. And, you know, I remember his divorce from Ivana and Marla Maples and all the tabloid stuff. So when I first saw him, was working at Miss Teen Universe, or Miss Universe. And that's when he came out and he would line up the contestants. I don't know if you've seen me speak about that. It's gone viral in my comedy, but he would line up all the contestants. And the first year he did this, if you're doing a live television show, it's very expensive, right? You have union labor. The Directors Guild of America is all the cameramen and stuff. So you got guys that are getting paid a fortune to be on set and ready to shoot. So Trump came out, lined up all the girls, and started inspecting them. He was walking up and down the line and like making little notes. He stuck his fingers in their teeth and was like checking to see which one had teeth that he liked. He was doing all these crazy things. This is all true, you know, and cameramen were going home and like telling their wives about it. Like, you won't believe what a pig this guy is in real life. You know, just crazy, like abusing his power. But anyway, he came out and did that and cost an hour of production time, right? He cost that production, you know, $75,000, $100,000, because nobody could get anything done. So you think that people would be like, this is crazy. You know, we can't allow this to exist. That's not what happened. The next year when people came to work, they had written it into the production schedule. Trump inspects contestants. That's what Trump does. And that was my first lesson, was like, wow, he got away with being the biggest pig you could be and totally abusing his power. But because he owns the pageant, because it's on network TV and it's making money for people, they're going to let him do what he wants to do. That's Trump being Trump. And on those same shows, he would come into the TV truck. Now, I'm a guy who's, at this point, I'm a PA. So I'm running around getting water for people and, you know, dealing with dressing rooms. But I would hear the ADs and the directors talk about him and be like, can you believe he came into the truck? And he'd come into the TV truck. You know, there's a remote trailer, basically, where they do all the editing and tell everybody, you know, what camera to go to and such. He would come into the truck and point at the monitors and say, get a close-up on her. And he'd, you know, say T-I-T-S and stuff. You know, he'd use gross slurs and stuff, racial slurs. He had no filter, even back then, but he got away with it. The other big memory I have from him in the 90s, besides that lesson, and I mention that because your listeners, that's what we've seen as president. You know, he does these outrageous things and you think he's never going to get away with this, but he does. It, people come to accept it. And they're like, that's just Trump being Trump. You know, he had to be flown off of an island. He was in Trinidad and attacked one of the contestants and they flew him off the island. You know, this is long before he became, you know, Celebrity Apprentice and The Apprentice. So he was able to exist in an industry which allowed somebody like that to exist because there was money to be made. And that's shameful all around. And I guess I play a part in that. I wasn't a producer. I'm not making excuses for myself. That was just kind of Hollywood at the time in the 90s. The other big memory was I was working on a VMAs. This is all well before The Apprentice. So this would have been probably 98. And I remember he brought Ivanka as his date. She probably was around 16 or 15. He brought her as his date, but we were doing an MTV VMAs at Radio City. And we had 50th Street actually blocked off for like a red carpet, you know, between 6th Avenue and 5th. And he gets out of his limo and I'm out there on the street on the carpet and I'm standing next to an NYPD officer. And he gets out and I'm like, hey, look, it's Donald Trump. Like, we're laughing, you know? And he's like, yeah, I used to work on his security detail. That guy's the biggest such and such hound in the city. And he used a P word, you know, hound as the city. And I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, I was on his detail. He'd be out every night in nightclubs. He's getting high. He's hitting on models. That guy's a crazy, like just a crazy partier, you know? And this guy, and he didn't mean like crazy partier, like fun, good times. He just meant like, you won't believe like what this guy gets up to at night. And that was another part of Trump is that he always had NYPD security around him. You know, that's why he's gotten away with all he's gotten away with. It was no secret who he was, but he was able to become who he was and continue to be who he was because he would have big cops. You know, Keith Schiller, he brought him to DC. That's an ex-NYPD rammer. You know, his job was busting down doors. So he'd have like this intimidating footprint that was basically like, I can do whatever I want. He's carried that attitude into the White House. We're all seeing the results of that now.
Noel Kassler, during the 90s, of course, there were all kinds of stories about people like Harvey Weinstein or Michael Jackson, and everyone shrugged them off. It was only years later that the bill eventually came due on all of them except Donald Trump.
Yes, and I've worked with both of those guys too, you know. And in full disclosure, I've known Bob Weinstein for a long time. And I've worked with Harvey on a lot of shows. And that was no secret. You know, what Harvey was up to was no secret. I worked with Michael Jackson, too. I stopped being his escort because he freaked me out too much. I didn't see what he was later accused of or accused of with the little boys, but I got a very weird vibe from him.
In 2015 and 16, you went to the Clinton campaign with some of these stories. What was their response?
They actually approached me. I worked on both of Barack Obama's, President Obama's inaugurations. And I had a friend who had worked on the Obama inaugurations who was then on the, you know, on the Clinton campaign, the Hillary Rodham Clinton campaign. So I was doing the New Yorker Festival in New York. I remember it vividly. I was with Springsteen that day and we were doing a big book talk. And I got a message from her and she said, I know you've been speaking out on Facebook and stuff, which many people who had worked on the show had been doing. People started like trading these anecdotes and being like, can you believe this guy's the Republican nominee? Remember that time he did this and remember that time he did that? Because everybody has these stories, right? Mark Burnett got wind of this, that people were starting to speak out and threatened to sue anybody who broke their NDA, because everybody had an NDA, because Trump wasn't this billionaire guy. When they shot the first season of Apprentice, where I wasn't there, but my friends were the production cast. I came in when it was Celebrity Apprentice, because I deal with celebrity talent. But when my friends were just doing the regular show, they showed up to shoot the first season, and the furniture in Trump's office was so threadbare that they were like, nobody's going to believe this guy's a billionaire. So they actually had to go out and rent furniture to make him look wealthier. And people don't realize that. They think he ran this big multinational corporation. It was a mom and pop shop. You know, it's a real estate company with like 20 employees, three of which are like his kids, you know? So it's like this one floor in Trump Tower with this ratty furniture. And Mark Burnett and his team go in there and they have to figure out, like, how do we sell this guy as a billionaire? You know, and that's what they did through editing, you know, through these power shots. Reality was Trump can barely read. He's severely dyslexic, as you can see now when he's president. He's always reading with his finger and he stumbles over three syllable words. So he was anything but like a with it kind of businessman who was in control. He would barely show up for the tapings. They would have to edit stuff together. They would cancel more days than not. He never picked the person who was the winner. They would tell him who to pick when he showed up for the finales. So it really was an illusion. And Mark Burnett went to Russia first. He went to Putin and wanted to do a reality show on the Mir space station and some funding that it got from an oligarch. And they said, no, the guy you want to do the show on is Donald Trump back in New York City. And I always thought that was very interesting. And that's a fact. You can look it up. It's in The New Yorker. There was a great piece on the producers of The Apprentice. So they wanted to go to Russia and they were told by the Russians to go to New York City. So then they create this image of this successful American businessman that, by the way, is also fitting in with the archetype of like your Fox viewer, you know, your NASCAR viewer, the vein of American media that Rupert Murdoch had already successfully been exploiting. Mark Burnett was able to sort of create a superhero in that same mold and sell him to middle America, you know? And that's how he had the power to run for president. Because like you said at the top of the show, New Yorkers knew about him. We knew he was a joke. We saw Atlantic City. We knew anything he touched went bankrupt, you know? He was not this successful guy. Trump Tower is not a place where people like aspired to live. It's not a dump, but it's not, you know, it's not a co-op on Park Avenue, right? So he wasn't what he was presented to be. It was a work of pure fiction.
You're listening to an interview with Noel Casler, who worked on Celebrity Apprentice for 6 years and is a writer on Twitter and is currently working on a book about his experiences. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. Noel Casler, my feeling in 2016 was that anybody who has a hotel in Atlantic City has to be affiliated with the mob. A friend of mine who works in Manhattan real estate also told me that it's impossible to be legal and be successful if you're a real estate developer in New York. Those two facts did not come together until after he was elected. And your story, going back to you, why didn't the Clinton campaign pick up on any of this?
I don't know. I mean, I told them, and I know that, you know, I have the email chain of the people I spoke with, and they believed everything I said. Their focus was mainly on the sexual assaults, you know, and the sexual harassment that I saw him do. I told them about the Adderall abuse and stuff. And they put me in touch with People Magazine. You know, their play was like, we're going to put you in touch with People. I gave an interview to People Magazine. They told me they were going to run it as a cover story because one of their authors had been assaulted by him at Mar-a-Lago in a bedroom. That's all documented. You know, she's come out with that. So they were going to run a cover story on Trump's history of you know, sexual harassment / sexual assault. And the week it was supposed to come out, they came out with a feature on Nancy O'Dell's divorce, you know, the host of Entertainment Tonight. So my feeling was always that there was some sort of catch and kill involved. You know, I don't know if it was Michael Cohen or somebody, but some pressure was put on People Magazine. They didn't run the story. The other part of that is the feeling I got from Hillary's campaign right around the time we spoke, the Access Hollywood tapes came out. So I think they felt, as many of us did, that like, this is it. He's done now anyway. Like, what more do we even know, or do we even have to do, rather, that he's saying it himself? Everyone knows the Access Hollywood tapes and what he said about women and how he likes to grab them. So I felt like they probably thought that was enough. They didn't need to push harder. And they also didn't see the Comey thing coming, as you remember, like a week before when sure. Comey said there was another investigation. So that hadn't happened yet, and I think, I'll put it another way, I got a big sense of confidence from Hillary's campaign. So my info landed in that environment, so to speak, you know, in an overly confident environment. So they reached out to me, and I gladly told them what I knew. And then he won. And then I left my industry and became a stand-up comedian to spread the word further and to process it almost as an artist, to say, look, you guys need to know who this guy is. Now that he's president, this is what he did.
The stories that appeared within a year from places like The Atlantic and New Republic, which documented the money laundering through the mob, documented Deutsche Bank and all of that was kind of set aside because the assumption was simply that Hillary was going to win.
Exactly. You know, the New York Times, they were sort of addicted to doing the, you know, the stories on Hillary's emails and all this kind of stuff. But yes, they knew or thought Hillary was going to win based on their polling. And the other thing is, this stuff wasn't a secret. You know, James Zirin wrote a great book about it called Plaintiff in Chief that came out a couple years ago. And he goes back, he was a former SDNY prosecutor, and he examined like the 4,000 lawsuits that Trump had been involved in, you know, since the early 70s when he was being sued by the Department of Justice for racial discrimination and housing and stuff. And there's a great story in there which is factually based up. You mentioned like you can't build in New York City without being mob related. So the summer that Trump Tower was completed was the summer of 1982. There was a Teamster strike in New York City. Teamsters are the ones that drive the cement trucks. Trump famously built the building out of cement and concrete and cheaper materials. His cement wasn't moving, right? He can't get his stuff poured because nothing's moving in New York City. So he makes a deal with the Teamster head, the president of the Teamsters Union, that he'll give a free penthouse condo away to his mistress, the Teamster's mistress, even though she has no visible means of income, if the concrete flows. You know, and the next morning the concrete started flowing, which also, you know, Fat Tony Salerno was involved in. So that's a pure mob thing. And James goes into it in great detail. I would recommend that. But so yes, you had to play ball with the mob. Trump had been doing that forever. He did it in Atlantic City. And the other thing I like to make about him is that Trump, you know, he'd build these things in Atlantic City and then he would like stiff the guy who put in the carpeting. You know, he'd stiff the tradesman that put in the brass railing in the Taj Mahal, right? You don't do that in South Jersey unless you're basically untouchable.
Well, I want to get back to Noel Cassler and your own dealings, what you saw. The difference between Donald Trump, the fictional character created by Mark Burnett, and the actual individual, and the conflation of the two into this president. Among the things you have said, discussing people's personal issues, it's kind of tacky. And some people say we shouldn't do this, and others say at the same time, well, Donald Trump is such a hypocrite anyway. He's several inches shorter than he claims to be, correct?
Yeah, he wears lifts, 3-inch lifts in his shoes. He's probably around 6 foot, and he tries to say he's 6'3". And I'm somebody who's 5'7". You know, I'd take the 6 foot, you know, to have to be 6'3" when you're clearly not. So yeah, he would wear lifts in his shoes. He wore a girdle because he's very overweight. And there's the other thing I think you're getting at. You know, he was incontinent, so he wore Depends, adult diapers. And I point that out not to mock him, though that's the way it comes across on Twitter. He does that because he's been addicted to stimulants, you know, since the 80s. So if you're using stimulants all the time, you become incontinent because it works as a diuretic in your bowels. And he also eats cheeseburgers, you know, not hamburgers and meatloaf. He only eats meat and stuff. So his colon is shot, and that would literally be a production issue in shooting this show. And I point it out because it is our business when he's president of the United States, because he hasn't been forthcoming.
You say it became a production issue. I mean, how did you work around it?
He would soil himself, and then you'd have to stop shooting, and they would bring him off set and change him.
And all of the contestants knew this?
Not all the contestants, because the contestants weren't always there when they're doing boardroom shots and stuff. It never happened like live on the air when they're doing a, you know, a finale. It happened when he had to read cue cards. He doesn't like to read. He gets really freaked out. So if he'd see a three-syllable word like arbitrage, is the example I remember most vividly, you know, he started screaming that the script department was trying to set him up because he can't see or pronounce the word. So he's just doing a rehearsal, sees something he doesn't like, flies into a rage, becomes very flatulent, and evacuates his bowels, and you cannot continue to shoot after that. So yes, crew and some cast members, but it wasn't like he wasn't doing it, you know, in front of everybody.
And the Adderall addiction, snorting Adderall?
Yeah, that's no secret. I mean, that he was doing that. He does it as president. You can see clips of it flying out of his nose. And again, I spoke about that because somebody in active addiction is the last person you want making decisions for the nation, you know, because an active addict is somebody who's only thinking about themselves. And if you look at his tweets, it's all self-centered fear and resentment, all these issues that you deal with if you're an addict. And he uses it, when I saw him use it, he would use it because he couldn't read and it made him feel in control. That's why if you see him giving a speech, he's sniffing all the time. Or in the debates with Hillary, he was sniffing all the time. Or in the first debate with Joe Biden, he does it when he has to speak publicly. It makes it feel like his brain is working better. And he's been doing that, you know, the anecdotes of him doing that, not just what I saw. I got friends who, you know, been done cocaine with him, and he would bring, I don't want to get too into it here, but, you know, he would have unsavory types come to the after parties. Let's just put it that way. And it was clear what they were there for. And you know, it would be on his nose. Like, you would have to send hair and makeup in to clean it up. And your viewers can go look up these clips as president. They're all out there. The first thing he did when he was elected president, because he was shocked. He didn't think he was going to win the thing ever. You know, and either that's a whole nother show if you want to get into how he won. You know, we know there was interference, but he was very shocked that night. One of the first things he did was he sent Keith Schiller, who's his body man, his lawyer Alan Garten, and another guy to his doctor's office, which is this guy Harold Bornstein on the Upper East Side, who's basically a Dr. Feelgood. You know, he's been sued for over-prescribing opioids, and women have died all over the Upper East Side that had this guy as a doctor. You know, he's a guy who wrote scripts, and your viewers can look this up too. You look at the guy's picture and you can tell what business he's in. But he was Trump's main physician since the early 80s. He's a gastroenterologist. So as one of the first actions Trump took was sending his bodyguards up there in the morning. They pushed the doctor aside and stole all his medical records and walked out of there. And this doctor's on the record. You know, he told the New York Times it happened. So he did that not to hide his high cholesterol numbers. Do you follow what I'm saying? He did that so you wouldn't see who he was and what his you know, drug use was, his prescription drug use, you know? And that's why he got the same guys, Ronnie Jackson. You know, when he got to the White House, Ronnie Jackson was the guy who was like, he'd live to be 200 if he just, you know, ate less steak and stuff. So he gets these people and he corrupts them.
Do you think he actually had COVID?
That is a great question. In the beginning, I did. Now, I don't really think. Now, it seems so sketchy. And Sean Connolly was the third in line of those doctors willing to, you know, say anything on his behalf. So the way they handled that, I don't know that he did. He could have gone there for something else. You know, he had that mysterious visit in November the previous year to Walter Reed, where he just comes running out the side door, you know, of the White House, and they put him in the SUV and drove him up to Walter Reed. So it very well could have been connected to another health issue that they dealt with.
What about Tom Joseph, who thinks that there's dementia here?
I don't buy that. I know people like that site. That guy blocked me a long time ago for some reason, you know, because people kept adding me like, you need to check this guy out. And I had nothing bad to say about him. I just said, he doesn't have dementia. And I'll tell you why. Listen to Lev Parnas's tape that he released when they were talking about Maria Abramovich, when he goes, take her out. What's she doing? Take her out right now. Or listen to the Woodward tapes. If you listen to those tapes, he knows what he's doing. You hear him off the record and he's succinct and he's speaking clearly. Tom Joseph has never met Trump. People who haven't been around him don't know how messed up he is physically and how much drugs he uses. So it's easy to sort of superimpose a diagnosis of dementia on him. He knows what he's doing. I'm not saying his brain is healthy. You know, he hasn't fed it anything but sugar and fat and stimulants for 40 years, but his posture and all that stuff, that's from the girdle and the lifts, you know, his weak right hand. He might have had a stroke or something like that, but he doesn't have dementia. And I'll say one more thing. I don't trust that dementia talk because I almost felt in the beginning like this is a plant to give him an out. You know, when he goes to trial, hopefully for whatever he's done, he could be like, well, I just had dementia. I didn't even know what he was doing. So long way to answer, no, he doesn't have dementia.
What got me is after he lost the election to Biden and he began asking for money and saying he was going to fight, and then he takes all the money and keeps it for himself, I'm thinking, this guy is just grifting.
Yes.
It's all grift.
Exactly. That's exactly what it is. And it's $200 million. You know, he's raised $200 million. And it's not only that, it's in some political action committee where it's like a leadership pack, which means he doesn't have to disclose how he spends it. It doesn't. He can use it for anything he wants. And I know what he's using it for. You know, it's going right in his bank account. So it's not just like we're raising money to have a war chest for our next campaign. They're literally giving him money that he's going to spend on himself.
You've been listening to an interview with Noel Castler. What is your Twitter feed if people want to listen in?
It's Noel Castler Comedy. And the handle is at Castler Noel. That's CASLERNOEL.
I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. An extended version of this interview can be found as a Radio Walensky podcast in the Area 941 section of the kpfa.org website. Bookwaves is produced by Richard Walensky in the studios of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California.
This is KBOO Portland. Next up on an encore presentation of Black Book Talk, hosts Patricia Welch, Emma Jackson Ford, and O.B. Hill interview author Charlotte Sherman about her book Brown Sugar Babe for Beautiful Brown Skinned Children.
Let me tell you about this girl, maybe I should. I met her in Philly, and her name was Brown Sugar. See, we be making love constantly.